Accession number 28698, Reel 25.
You came back on what date?
25th of September, 93. And we had our leave, and then after leave, the commanding officer did a survey about how many blokes were in the battalion and how many were entitled to leave, since we'd had a large ban on PVRs, but people were due to leave on their normal run-out date. And it was worked out that would be 225 men below establishment. First time the battalion had ever been that low on men in the battalion. We also knew that there was going to be a merger from three battalions to two, and because of defence cuts and options for change that had come about. And I was asked by the CO, because I'd gone through all this in 1968, he said it was unfair that I should go through it again. And would I like to volunteer for a posting? And I said I was not. But then he came up and said, 125 Army Youth Team up at Horden required a new commander, and would I do it? And also that 125 would also be merged later on with 121 Army Youth Team up in Albemarle Barracks in Northumberland. And it would be multi-cab badged, and I had been requested to take this. So in the end, I said I would. And so in the September-October time, I actually moved up to Durham, lived at Bransworth Village, but operated out of Horden, closed that team down, and moved it up to Northumberland with 121 Army Youth Team, which was the biggest team in England.
What do you mean by team? Is that another name for a company, battalion, or what?
Well, no, it was a multi-cab badged team of adventure training instructors. I had artillery, I had fusiliers, I had engineers, I had light infantry, I had guardsmen, and several other cab badges. And I was asked by the director of Army Recruiting, which happened to be General Jack Deverell, one of our own. And he said it's most important that I physically took on this team, and he would support us.
So you were training officers and men in this routine, whatever it was?
No, our job really was, we're all in tracksuits, we didn't wear our uniform very often, and it was for the local population and school children from the age of 14 to 21 to not recruit into the army, but to make them aware of the army, and especially the adventure training side of the army. I think it was an agreement that the army's always had with the government that we would give civilian people adventure type training. The offshoot would be that they might join the army, but the other one was would give them some kind of discipline and an outlook on life, and especially leadership. And a lot of the schools we used to operate with were sixth form schools who would normally recruit people into the officer corps of the army. So it was an important job. So I merged the two, and they ended up being called 121 Army Youth Team. I had 12 instructors and two admin senior NCOs, and we used to operate with about 6,000 children a year. And 6 months of each year we spend down the Lake District from April to the end of October. And then it was getting too cold for children because we used to live out under canvas in the Lake District. And we used to take one climbing, abseiling, canoeing. I used to take all the hill walking because I was a joint service mountain expedition leader. And it was a service to the public. And we all also used to offer our services, because we're all climbers anyway, to the mountain rescue team of the Lake District.
How long would you have a group of children with you?
A week at a time. We'd take the first group down on Sunday. They would change over, maybe it's on a Friday. The next group would come, and we'd take them for 3 to 5 days. And we'd take the groups as long as we could while we're down the lakes. Then there'd be some schools said, can you come to the schools and teach us PT in the gymnasiums? So we'd take anything up to 600 kids in batches of 30 in the schools. And we all used to take them to Albemarle Barracks and abseil them off the water tower, which was 100-odd feet high, and then take them across the Army assault course. It was good publicity for the Army, and the schools and the local communities got a lot of benefit out of it. And I would like to think that some of the canoeists and that went on to bigger and better things, having been introduced to it by the Army Youth Team.
You must have been getting a good look at a cross-section of teenage youth at that time.
Yes, it was. The good schools were absolutely brilliant and a joy to take. But we also used to take the inner city of Newcastle and schools like that, who were out-and-out criminals, to tell the truth. And we also used to take people for the probation officers and for the police, who, again, were supposed to give them a look at life, but used to use us as the instrument to teach them. And they were deaf and blind, that they didn't want to be on top of mountains and in canoes on Lake Windermere and all the rest of it. That was when they had arrived, because they realised they live in a tent with no electric, no nothing else. It was quite cold some nights, and when it rained, it rained. Within 2 or 3 days, they would look over the mountains and the lakes and realise how beautiful everything was. And it was fair to say, because we got it off the teachers and the police and that, how the children had changed. Once, and we never got messed around because they knew we were soldiers and they didn't try to buck our discipline. And I would like to think we changed quite a few people's minds from being ram raiders and little thieves and thugs to being disciplined people. And we got a lot of pleasure out of it ourselves. Anyway, I did that job for about 15 months. And then it was mentioned that I was to go back to regimental duties as a quartermaster. So in June 1994, I was sent down again to Blackdown Camp in Surrey to do my 6 weeks quartermaster's course, which was almost the same as the RQMS's course, but at a different level up. And then I took over 7LI TA in Bishop Auckland from Tony Bradford, who was the major from the Green Jackets, and he was retiring full time.
And had you been promoted now from lieutenant?
Yes, I was a captain. In fact, I'd been a captain since I was the family's officer. And so I was a captain now, captain quartermaster, and I had an RQMS called Tony Marone, who had also been a Royal Marine Artillery from 7-9 Battery. He'd been a long-standing RQMS. He was on a non-permanent regular staff, warrant officer to RQMS, and he taught me a lot. He got me settled into the battalion. He taught me an awful lot to do about the TA soldiering, especially at camps and on our Skill at Arms meeting. And I picked a lot up from the permanent staff instructors and from the RQMS. And I started to learn a new trade as the quartermaster.
The TA man would probably need a slightly different approach from the regular.
Oh, absolutely. Although a lot of them had been ex-regular and some from my own battalion, which was a pleasure to see them. But yes, you couldn't snarl. And the bit that was different was, if they lost their equipment on an exercise, they didn't expect to pay for it. Because they had this system in the TA that they would have exercise losses and the public purse would pay for it. I wasn't having any of this and I used to make them pay for it. And they soon realised to look after the kid better because they weren't getting anything for free off me.
How did they develop as soldiers, you know, as weekend soldiers?
Absolutely brilliant. I've never seen so much dedication from the majority. They knew they were only there on Tuesdays and Thursday nights and weekends. And the same people would turn up all the time. And they were dedicated to the time they were allotted for training. They trained hard. The shooting team was second to none in the country. They would always come back from Bisley with a barrel load of silver. The recce platoon and their drills was absolutely fantastic. And it was a pleasure to see semi-professional soldiers being professional.
Had you the feeling that they would fit in well in a situation where they had to go back to war? Well, and quickly, of course.
I wasn't so sure in them days, but since the Iraq War started, we now know that their training has proved to be the support all they needed to get into a regular battalion and act as a professional soldier. And this was quite obvious during the camps at Senilaga training area and at Thetford, where again they did parts of Northern Ireland training, parts of everything else that the regular army was doing at the time. And they proved to be quite professional. And it was a pleasure to actually be their quartermaster. Anyway, after my 2-year appointment, it was told I was going to Wannerlei in Paderborn, Germany, as the OCA Quarter Company, and that the OCA Quarter Company for Wannerlei would come to Bishop Auckland as QM. In fact, they went off to Bosnia, and after on the return from Bosnia, the major that was going to take over from me physically went out of the army as a non-regular permanent staff PSEO down in Wakefield, Yorkshire. And I was cajoled to stay in it with the battalion for an extra year, which I did. And that took me through to...
Was this with one ally, sorry?
I had to stay with seven ally.
Seven
the extra year. So I did 3 years of the quartermaster with the TA unit, which took me up to 1997, September of. But at the same time, I was getting my substantive major. So I was being promoted at the same time. And it was requested that I go to the Green Jackets as their quartermaster in Bulford. And because I had grandchildren down in Amesbury, about 4 miles away, I said I would take the job, and I did. So I moved off to Bulford in September 97 as quartermaster of 1RGJ.
Same situation, were they welcoming? And because you'd been with them once before, hadn't you?
I thought because I'd been with 2RGJ that I wouldn't know anybody in 1RGJ. But they were like the light infantry a year earlier when they'd been merged, that the two was one. So I was surprised of how many soldiers, and especially the senior ranks and the officers, that I really did know. So I settled straight away in. And the first day I was there, they made me run my BFT, which is the basic fitness test, that a young man has 10 minutes to do, and people my age then, because I'm now 47, nearly 48, had about 25 minutes. But I was still so fit, I was doing it 9.5 minutes, which shocked the battalion to realise an old quartermaster like me was still running that fast. And then I did the same on my infantry combat fitness test, which made them think, oh no, Lawton's back with all his discipline and his fitness training. So I fitted straight in. It was then mentioned that I would spend 1.5 years in Bulford with them. Then they were going off to Northern Ireland. Would I go to Northern Ireland as their quartermaster as well? So I said I would. So we exercised in Senate Bridge and various other areas in Salisbury Plain while we were stationed in Bulford. And then in the January of 1999, I was told that I would go to Holywood Barracks in Palace Barracks, Holywood, in Belfast, in the February of 99, as their quartermaster. So I did. And the strange thing is, the battalion in Palace Barracks at the time was 2 ally, my own battalion. So I took over as quartermaster from the quartermaster who had been the RSM, who took over from me in 1990.
Well, when you take over, you presumably have some listing of what you were taking over.
There's ledgers of everything that is in the camp.
That would have to be checked, presumably,
including beds, pillars, slips, knives, forks, spoons, and everything in the messes, the accommodation, all the Northern Ireland specialist equipment, and then all the tools, vehicles, and ammunition in the quartermaster store. Every single item is counted over a 3-week period, handed over to the incoming battalion, in my case, me. That battalion moves off, and they took our camp over in Bulford, and we took their camp over in Belfast. The quartermaster man, Tom Smith, at the time, from the Green Jackets, was retiring, and that's why they wanted me to go to Ireland and said, will you stay the extra 2 years? So I did.
And this was a 2-year tour?
And this was a 2-year tour from March 1999 to March 2001.
Was it quiet?
It was quiet every time until it came up to the 12th of July time and the Protestants would kick off, and then you'd have the riots on the street again, the big crowds, the music and everything that went with it. But by now, we're letting the IUC and the Irish battalions be more at the forefront, and we were always in support. The millennium came, and it seemed that peace had finally arrived in Northern Ireland. The people were absolutely fantastic. This was Protestants and Catholics together in all the main towns and all the pubs and restaurants in Belfast. The atmosphere was electric. And at midnight on Millennium Night, all the car horns were tooting, ships were tooting, lights were flashing on the ferries and the boats. The airport was lit up. There was beacons all up and down the locks and Stranraer. Everything. It was absolutely fantastic. I walked out on Christmas, on New Year's Day, down to Bangor, walked the dog down there, and the fountains were all full of foam and coloured dyes and champagne bottles, and it was absolutely brilliant.
So those barriers seem to have gone.
We thought they had, and it was a pleasure to be in Belfast, and it was not always a pleasure to be in Hollywood, because again, the people were brilliant, the restaurants were gorgeous. And then July came, and it started all over again with the Protestants again. And we were involved in the riots more so. But at the same time, we were closing different army bases down. And I was in charge of closing these six-month camps down. And then battalions were going back to England, not to come back again. And we were closing blocks of flats down or handing them back to the civilian population that we'd lived in now for 30 years. And I was doing a lot of work at night time and having to go in at midnight and come back out at 4 o'clock in the morning. And but all these bases were being handed over, and so it was a step forward to normality as we thought it was all going to be. And that kept me going till March 2001, and then it was time to prepare for the handover of Palace Barracks to the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. Which I did successfully. The battalion of Green Jackets were then going to Wheaton, where I'd been in the 80s, and I had no inkling to go back there. Not that it was a nice place, I just didn't want to go back to UK. So I applied for a post, and in fact I applied for Canada, Kenya, Brunei, Belize and Nepal. And the army said, you can go to Senalaga as the chief range officer. So it was arranged that I, when the battalion went to Wheaton, I would then go the other way. So I packed my Marie Quarter up, packed my furniture in my house and everything up, and Turi and I went on the ferry to Germany and parted with the battalion. So we arrived in Senalaga in the March of 91.
2001.
2001, sorry. And I went on a quick leave, came back, and then took over from a Welsh Guards Major as the Chief Range Officer of Senalaga Rangers. Later that year, it was announced that in October that year, I picked up the MBE that the Green Jackets had obviously put me in for, and I was supposed to go in the November to Buckingham Palace to receive the MBE. But I fell off my bike, pedalling through Senalaga camp and broke my left arm or my left wrist. And of course I was plastered from my finger ends to my elbow, I couldn't get my uniform on, so I had to ring Buckingham Palace up and said I can't come for my MBE investiture. And they arranged that I would go in the March the following year, which I did.
And that must have been quite a moment.
Yes it was, because it was totally unexpected, and it had a lot to do with the work I'd done in Northern Ireland, obviously. And I went there, so I made a four-day event of it and toured London, took my wife, went to some shows. My sons came down to the investiture, and I made the most of the occasion.
And the Queen would give me this?
No, the Queen had gone off to... If I'd gone in the November, the Queen would have done the investiture, but she'd gone off to New Zealand. So Prince Charles presented the MBE, and it was absolutely brilliant.
Did he say anything to you particularly?
Yes, we did. Most people got the customary 30 seconds. I seemed to be there for 4 or 5 minutes, which everybody thought was strange. But mine was an operational MBE, where most of the other people, or all the other people, had been MBEs for dance, music, painting, and a variety of other things. But what surprised me was Prince Charles knew everything about me and everything about what I'd done in Northern Ireland. So he was briefed in a matter of seconds. And for him to regurgitate that back to me, I found fascinating. And I found him fascinating as well.
And, of course, the honour itself is quite something to come down.
Oh, absolutely brilliant. And I was very surprised that the Green Jackets had put me in for it, being a light infantry man. However, hey-ho, it was there. and they wrote me up well.
So what happened to you next?
Well, I stayed on as the chief range officer, and I think I managed to spend over the next 3 years about £12.5 million on Senlager Rangers, because when I got there, it was no different from me being there in the early 70s. Everybody was still dug underground and everything was handheld and turning wheels and pulling levers. A programme had already started just before I arrived to convert it into remote control targetry and electric target ranges, very much like the ranges in America. In fact, it was American kit that we were installing. So I had a big hand in that, and my job was to make rangers available for all battalions of all corps and infantry ranks to shoot when they needed to. And then after that, it was more to train people for Bosnia, for Kosovo, for Northern Ireland, and then for Iraq, for the Second War in Iraq. And I spent an awful long time putting people through the sausage machine, so that making sure they used the rangers to the best ability, 24 hours a day if necessary, 7 days a week, to make all the brigades of 4, 7 and 20 fully trained for Iraq. And that actually worked. And at the same time, we're continuing to build and modernise the rangers and put electric onto the rangers for the first time ever. Remember, these rangers had been used by Hitler to train his troops for the Second World War and Kaiser to train his troops for the First World War. And we were still using their old targetry. I was pleased after my final, when I finally left there, that everything had been modified. Health and safety standards had been raised, and I had had a good 3-year tour of Senlager. But my time was coming up for retirement, and I was going to stay in Germany as long as I could to come home ready for my retirement in 2005. But I was told if I was going to come back to UK for my last 6 months, and I wanted the army to pay for the removal of my furniture, I had to leave 6 months early. So in July of 2004, I made plans to come back to the UK. And just before that, I had an interview at the regimental office in Durham to take over as the regimental county secretary of the Light Infantry and the Durham Light Infantry. I was a successful candidate, so I took the job, came home in the July, did all my resettlement courses, and set my sights on retiring in the 21st of January 2005. The Major Randall Cross, who was already in the chair, was due to retire full-time in the November of 2004. So I said I would forego my leave, my resettlement training, and take over the job in the November, which I did. This hadn't been my first Christmas in England for many, many years. I settled down for Christmas at home instead of going to Austria like I used to. And on Christmas Eve, our last serving VC, Captain Dick Annand, died. I got the phone call on early hours of Christmas morning, went to the office as a complete stranger, knew nobody, and thought, now what do I do? When I settled down and started making phone calls, and then ringing Shirley Annand, the widow, up, and the Lord Lieutenant of Durham, and talking to various other people, I knew exactly what I was going to do, and started to prepare a military funeral to be held a week later in St. Cuthbert's Church in Durham. That was to be followed later in the first few days of February with a memorial service to Captain Annand VC in Durham Cathedral. Invitations went out, preparations were made. I asked Tuolai to provide buglers and various other escorts, and we had the memorial parade, and over 1,000 people attended. I then finally took my uniform off at the end of that parade, and that was the last time I wore a military uniform.